Welcome to the Ready Podcast. I'm Rebecca Riley, Associate Professor at City Ready, WM Ready, University of Birmingham. In our first series of podcasts, we'll be looking at megatrends in the West Midlands. WM Ready has developed evidence examining the impacts of COVID-19 on the West Midlands region by producing economic impact monitors and a State of the Region report with policy partners. The WMCA commissioned further work to look at the megatrends identified in the State of the Region 2020 report. This process has highlighted potential for the acceleration of existing trends by the COVID-19 crisis, culminating in new scenarios for future economic activity, life and places. Some examples of megatrends we explored include business models and operations, work and training, future health and green spaces, local living, changing city centre business districts, just cities, generational conflict, urban responses and economic shocks, future mobility and tactical urbanism. There is a gap in policymakers' understanding of whether these trends will continue, altering the structure of society and businesses in the longer term. These podcasts and the larger programme of work it's part of will help us explore selected trends and scenarios with policymakers locally and nationally in more depth, helping them formulate economic recovery policy which takes account of these changes. The scenarios identified could have significant economic consequences and scarring effects for vulnerable groups and places as a result of impacts on human, social, physical and natural capital. This research examines these impacts and trends, developing future scenarios in greater depth in order to identify, along with policymakers, those policies which may be more effective in restarting the economy, encouraging recovery, and creating long-term renewal by encouraging positive trends and mitigating negative effects. I hope you enjoy the series, and for a more detailed look at megatrends, please download and read the associated provocations and report on the topic, Megatrends in the West Midlands.
Welcome to the City Ready podcast. This is the first podcast in a series that will be examining megatrends in the West Midlands. Megatrends are major movements, patterns or trends that have transformative impact on business, economy, society, cultures and personal lives. This episode will be looking into business models and operations in the West Midlands. We'll be discussing key trends, impacts and opportunities for West Midlands cities. I'm Alice Pugh, a policy and data analyst at City Ready, University of Birmingham, and we'll be talking to Henrietta Breeler, CEO of the Greater Birmingham Chambers of Commerce. So, Henrietta, thank you for joining me.
I'm delighted to be here, Alice.
And for those of you who may not be aware of who you are, could you please introduce yourself?
Yeah, so the Greater Birmingham Chambers of Commerce, a business membership and support organisation that exists to connect, support and grow local businesses. And we employ around 80 members of staff, helping businesses with just about everything from growing their profile and finding customers locally through to keeping on top of the latest business news, views and trends, and particularly emerging challenges and developments that they need to be aware of topically for today, and also on trading internationally. And we've been in business for business for about 200 years.
Thank you. So I think over the last 2 years, there has been significant changes to business models. And especially with the pandemic, it's been a massive, I suppose you could call it mega trend in a way, because it's impacted everyone and it impacts all businesses, all countries, all economies. But it's especially accelerated certain trends that were already in development, such as hybrid working. So for me, I'd already worked as a flexi worker, but it was civil service, DWP, and they had already fully integrated hybrid working. So there were lots of staff who, especially for school runs and stuff like that, were already using that flexible working. I suppose the question is, do we think that that will remain part of businesses' models within the future going forward?
Yeah, it's been an absolutely fascinating time on that, hasn't it? And I can remember in the early days of the pandemic, While a lot of businesses had seen growing interest in flexible working and maybe experimented with some roles, actually the majority of SMEs had, for instance, only a few remote working licenses. So they had to adapt very quickly to being able to set up the majority, if not all, of their workforces from home. And now all signs do seem to point to flexible working is here to stay. You talk to the majority of large corporates in the city, apart from some very public exceptions. Goldman Sachs has been very open about their expectation that everyone will come back to work in the office 5 days a week. But the majority are looking more towards that hybrid model, that 2 or 3 days in, 2 or 3 days at home. And among SMEs, again, it's a bit of a mix. Some have decided to return back to the office full time. But for a lot, they've really adopted and embraced this and are expecting to see hybrid working moving forwards.
I suppose the trend massively depends on what sector you're in as well, doesn't it? Because it's going to be mainly services and professional businesses, finance, all those sorts of things, but it won't necessarily impact manufacturers in the same way at all. It massively depends on where you're going to be sitting, I think, in the future.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, there's certain things you definitely can't do from home, and that's, you know, manufacturing, construction. Can't do road repair from your living room. You know, it's very much the sort of services sectors that have been able to embrace this. But it has come with challenges too, as well as the sort of positives. You know, I think there's been plenty of research in recent years that actual productivity is viewed very positively when it comes to working from home, particularly individual level productivity. So if you've got something to do, getting it done from home, pretty effective. But the concerns I hear from employers are, well, how do you keep building team dynamics? How do you sort of create that feeling of belonging to an organisation if actually you may never have seen many of your colleagues in person and never have met them? It's leading to that whole new question of, well, what's the office for? When people are in the office, what are you doing to develop those team dynamics and really proactively invest in building team culture rather than just sort of coming in, sitting down and working through your working day? There's also been challenges raised with, how do you develop people? Because so much of what goes into development and experience in, say, an office environment is just seeing how your colleagues handle themselves, you know, seeing how people speak to others on the phone, having those really micro questions that you might not want to book in a Zoom call and ask someone about or send an email about. But if they're just over the desk, you can go, well, how'd you do that? Or how would you approach this? That is harder to recreate in a digital environment. So there's definitely a lot of positives in hybrid working, but something employers are still grappling with is, well, how do you retain some of the benefits that come from bringing people together? Some of those serendipitous and creative conversations. I think we're also not quite at a point where we know what the future is going to look like long term. You know, at the time of recording, we're still working through this latest wave of the COVID pandemic. So a lot of employers are reluctant to really emphasize returning to the office when actually it might not be in the best interest of the health of their employees at present. So I think we've still got a bit to work through on what will the new normal look like once we're through this latest wave and the pandemic truly is under control.
I suppose it's that question as well between innovation and productivity. So at home, you're more productive because there's less distractions potentially, or you can nip in to pick your kids up from school is a much shorter journey. But I suppose it's the innovation that you lose. Like you said, being able to chat to your co-worker next year and say, oh, how'd you do this? And I suppose it might be an age thing as well. So younger people are far more inclined to want to go in the office and actually learn from their more experienced colleagues, whereas I think older colleagues would be a bit more keen to stay at home, usually because of commitments that they have that their younger colleagues don't necessarily have yet.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you're a younger member of the team, odds are you don't have a great big home office that you can retreat into and have a lovely working environment set up at home. So there's those different sort of dynamics going on that I think employers are increasingly aware of. It's also an interesting question for central business districts and city centres, because obviously they've all been set up around high volumes of commuters coming in 5 days a week, going to cafes, popping into the shops, being there midweek. Whereas if we are seeing lower volumes of commuters coming in, then that does present an interesting question of, well, what does that mean for city centres? Are they going to change?
Well, I know when I was doing this provocation piece of work, the research work, I found that a lot of employers through different research centres after they've been surveyed were saying that they were going to shut down some of the offices in the city centres because now their employees didn't necessarily want to be in the city centres anymore. They preferred working from home and just coming in for a couple of days. So most businesses are keeping things like suites with large executive rooms so they can do workshops and all the rest of it, but they're reducing those standard office spaces where you're all sat in your little own at your own desk.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, you can still see in the data that we haven't returned to pre-COVID levels of footfall during the week. I'm a big fan of the Centre for Cities High Streets Recovery Tracker. It's something that, very nerdily, I've been glued to throughout the pandemic to see how city centres are faring and where's been doing better than others. And you can see it very clearly in Birmingham that actually weekend footfall is now back above pre-pandemic levels, but midweek is still notably below. And one of the big changes has been in the composition of that footfall. So there's a lower proportion of commuters coming in from outside the city making up that footfall during the week than there was pre-pandemic. So it's very clearly still having an impact.
It comes as well, there's this issue with, there was already a growing trend towards people going into city centres less because you didn't need to do the shopping there, and you could do that from home. You can just click on your mobile. Especially under the pandemic, it accelerated that trend, and we all became a little bit more reliant on just being able to click through our phone and buy things. And I suppose going into the city centre now would seem, unless you really want something specific that can only be sold at a certain store, it's going to be difficult for businesses to entice customers out to them potentially, especially like you said, during the week when you're not necessarily going to be there for work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we saw this happening pre-pandemic, that shift to the experience economy. We're already having plenty of sort of, you know, meetings and thought leadership sessions on how the nature of shopping districts was changing to lure people in with something that they can't get online. That experience piece, that sort of, you know, food fun and feeling fabulous. So your coffee shops and your restaurants, your interactive experiences, and then your sort of beauty salons and all of that type of activity. Mm. And that has just been rapidly escalated by COVID. Like many things, the COVID pandemic hasn't necessarily created new trends. It's just rapidly escalated them. And you can see how city centres were already starting to adapt. So now if you pop down to the Bullring, there's treetop mini golf in a big retail unit where previously it would have just been, you know, like your top shops and your sort of traditional retailers that have been some of the pandemic victims. You also see emerging experiences in other bits of retail. So there's a great high-end sneaker shop in the Bullring, and they quite often will have guest visits, sort of, you know, people dropping in and doing signings, your sort of local rappers and all of that type of activity to, again, give people something that they cannot get online. And that is only going to increase as this generation continues to prefer to shop online. I think there's some great data out there on the proportion of transactions that are done online, and the majority are now done through smartphones. And that move from going, oh, I want to go into a city centre because I want to look at things and buy things, to actually I want to go into a city centre because I want to have a good experience, is well and truly underway.
I think it's other things as well, like, so there's been this rise in vintage, because for things like vintage, you've got to go to the actual place and really you've got to look at it because you can't see it anywhere else. And it's like you said, like shops like Primark did attempt to do online sales, but the demand, they couldn't cope with the demand under their business model. So instead, they change their physical stores. So now you can go to the hairdressers, you can go to the barbers, you can go get your art nails done, your brows done. You can, there's usually a themed cafe in there. So like there's the Manchester one in Friends or the Disney one in Birmingham. And I think it's going to be the way forward, is that you're going to need more multi-purpose spaces. So for instance, I know in Manchester we have a place called the Great Northern where you get lots of little pop-up stores. So these pop-up stores that stay for a set period of time and then move on to the next city, and they just keep rotating around each city around the UK.
Yeah, so it's a new experience every time. I think there's also something around curating of city centres. So Colmore Bid did a fantastic bit of work on future business districts in partnership with the University of Birmingham, I do believe. And one of the key recommendations from that was that the local authority look at employing a fantastically titled curator general. And the role of that curator general would be to curate the city centre, put on events, markets, performances, all of those types of activity that you really can't get at home, but lure people in. And then when they're in, yes, they will visit the coffee shops, they will visit the sort of retail outlets and drive up that footfall. And one opportunity that we really have at the moment with Birmingham is the Commonwealth Games Cultural Festival, which is just phenomenal. You know, I don't know if you saw the Wondrous Stories performances down in Centenary Square, but it's all aerial acrobatics, absolutely extraordinary. And the footfall numbers from that are looking pretty good already. But there's a month's worth of activity. It's going to be going on until at least September, the Commonwealth Games Cultural Festival. And when I've been talking to employers about, you know, the challenge they might have of luring people back in and giving them a reason to come back into the office in the city centre, well, that really is something you can't get at home. And there are all sorts of fantastic things planned over the coming months.
Yeah, I think events like that, because it was the same when it happened with Liverpool, when Liverpool was the city of culture, it went mad. And I remember going up and seeing all the boats. And I suppose it's those big events, especially community ones, that bring people in. And I know that the LEPs have been working really hard at getting local schools involved with volunteering for projects and especially helping businesses find apprentices for helping with catering and all those sorts of things that are needed for events. I think going forward, those events will mean much more to city centres in general to get customers in, because otherwise, like I said, we'll all be online shopping and no one will want to go in. I suppose one advantage of the online shopping for the West Midlands itself is that we have the Golden Triangle for the logistics, which is partly here and partly in the East Midlands. So we have been having this rapid growing distribution industry within the West Midlands, which, again, as we've seen, we're not necessarily dealing with very well on the supply side, especially with labour and supporting it. So do we think that that industry is going to continue to grow across the West Midlands in the future?
Oh, absolutely. It's clearly an area in high demand. And talking to property sector folks, that sort of industrial premises for those large footprint distribution sites, there is a big pipeline of demand for. So I think we're only going to be seeing more of that over the coming months and years. And like you say, it's very convenient being in the Midlands because we are literally, by virtue of the name, at the heart of the UK's road, rail and air networks as well. So we're perfectly situated to make the most of it. It does, like you say, present some challenges with, like you said, what's the future of city centres if we are all moving to this more online trade type piece? And then also finding people with the right skills and in the right places to take up those jobs as they grow is an area of concern, not just for logistics, but for many industries in our current great resignation, post-pandemic type era that we seem to be in. But overall, it's a great opportunity for the region to continue to grow in that industry.
I suppose the other big impact, especially on logistics companies and online companies, has been automation and developing technologies. And I think that's all rapidly accelerated under COVID as well, especially when employers looking at the staff and sort of considering, you know, would it be better to get these processes automated? Or they've had staff that were sent away under the pandemic only to realise that they weren't necessarily key to their business model anymore. So I think that acceleration is going to greatly impact, especially in the West Midlands, where you've got lots of car manufacturers and lots of food manufacturers. And especially in Birmingham specifically, it might be an issue when you've got such high unemployment at the minute, especially in the manufacturing industry that's rapidly decreasing. And what would you do with that staff that's specifically trained in a certain sector in the future?
Yeah, it's one of the fascinating challenges, isn't it, of where does automation lead to? And I know there was a Warwickshire Economics study back in 2018 looking at jobs where daily tasks have at least 70% chance of being carried out by robots or computers. And they identified that as many as 39.6% of jobs in the West Midlands Combined Authority area could fall into that camp, hypothetically. So it is one where you go, okay, this could be a real area of concern if this happens very, very quickly. And those people who were in those roles aren't reskilled and supported into other roles. I think the interesting thing will be the speed at which this happens, because we've seen from other research that McKinsey estimates that the pandemic sped up investments in digital transformation by about 3 years compared to where it would naturally have been. And whether that trajectory continues or whether actually it goes back to that sort of slower pace but ongoing change is a bit of a question mark. We do not know for sure. because one of the real challenges is digital adoption, particularly when you get down to SME level. Actually, in theory, there are a whole lot of things that could already be replaced by automation, by bots, by emerging AI, but in practice haven't yet been adopted and fully embraced and developed by the local business community, because actually this sort of thing is really hard to do in practice. In theory, it's fantastic, but in practice, it's very hard to do and do well, because it requires a complete rethinking of business processes, organisational structures and strategies. It's not just a case of going, here's something we've always done and now we're going to do it through a digital programme. It's we need to change the way we conceptualise the problem, deal with the problem and the processes that we have in place to do it. So it's probably not going to happen as quickly as we might think, but certainly what that means is there is actually time to look at this and go, well, how do we invest in upskilling these people whose jobs may be at risk? And I know there's some great programs from the West Midlands Combined Authority, from the SWAPS, the sector-based work academy somethings, which are very sector-focused projects with further education to look at individual sectors and how they can reskill and upskill people in those workforces, right the way down to digital boot camps to support sort of bite-sized learning for people who are looking to move into more digital careers and roles who may not have had previous experience there. So there are some good projects underway to support that already. I think the interesting question is always, you know, will it result in less jobs overall? Will there in future be fewer jobs to go around? And I know that that was sort of the concern from the Industrial Revolution and everything that happened afterwards. And I think at one point Keynes was predicting we might even drop down to a 15-hour working week because we'd all become so productive as an economy that we wouldn't need to work any more than that to get done what we needed to and buy what we wanted. That didn't quite happen. So I think we'll create new jobs at almost the same rate that existing jobs change or disappear.
Yeah, the 70s hit Keynesianism hard. So, I suppose it's going to be that whole upskilling and reskilling thing of staff, definitely. And I think the problem is as well is that, especially with digitisation, is that there's a massive security risk to it all. So how are businesses going to cope with it? Because it's not just training your staff, it's the expense of implementing those costly pieces of software that actually protect your business. And especially under COVID as well, we've all seen it, those dodgy messages you might get on Facebook. Someone wants to message you, or, you know, I saw you look at, you know, trying to get money out of you, or your text from HMRC. And the question is what are businesses actually doing to protect their own business models from malicious attacks?
Yeah, it is a top concern for a number of businesses. You know, there are organisations I know that have been victims of malware attacks, and the disruption is huge in terms of sort of immediate business, but then also to reputational concerns as well. And at the moment, there is a heightened risk of cyber attacks, even more so than usual, thanks to another of the side effects of the war in Ukraine, and the risk of sort of spillover from malicious actors actively sort of putting out viruses and malware that then spread beyond their initial targets and into the wider business community, but also potentially from ransomware and scammers, as there are people with those skills in Russia and the economy is hitting a really difficult time there. So there is a risk that we will see an increase in those sort of attacks that are aimed at just making money. So it is a concern. I think in terms of what businesses are doing about it, the main piece is really that human factor. So yes, having the right systems and processes in place, but actually, like with anything, your weak points are your people and the risk that they might click on the link from that dodgy text from HMRC, or, you know, open something that says, please pay this invoice that appears to come from the chief executive. So, and there's, have you ever seen You've Been Pwned?
Yeah.
It's terrifying, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
For listeners, that's a website where you can put in your email address and it will pull up every time your email address has been involved in a data breach. And that data has then been dumped on the dark web. And some of those data breaches will also involve passwords. So if your employee has used their work email address and they happen to use the same password for a different website and for your login into work, that could be a huge risk. And it is terrifying how often data breaches happen. So that educating employees about what could be malicious, what potential consequences could be, and how to keep their own data safe is really important. I know that the Chamber will do all sorts, from sort of a couple of annual phishing tests through to sort of reports on where data breaches have taken place, just to make sure that we are keeping our employees up on this, as well as keeping our systems up and running.
And talking about Russia and Ukraine, because I wrote this way before any of this happened, but there's something to be said in the future about the shortening of supply chains, I suppose, because right now we're seeing the impact of how global issues are impacting supply chains that you think are far, far, far away. But actually, it has real impact on the cost of producing anything. So, like in Ukraine, it's sunflower oil, which is impacting businesses, driving up prices. And you're, and because we're already going through a cost of living crisis, it just makes everything worse. So I think there will be some definite reshoring of production maybe in the future, or shortening of supply chains to try and to stick to more closer countries so that those shocks can be kept at bay, I suppose. But that will mean massive changes in business models away from a globalized model to a more localized model.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because there's some things that you can't localize no matter what you want to do. And that can involve where commodities are extracted from. And they really do sit right at the base of supply chain. I mean, who'd have thought that over 40% of the world's palladium comes from Russia? No one until this. And who knew that palladium was a key ingredient in microprocessors? Not me before this. So that whole global supply chain disruption piece is very front of mind. And I think there will be, as you say, some shortening of supply chains and also perhaps changes in business models from those who had relied on just-in-time delivery as a really efficient model to actually having to stockpile and keep more in stock as well to reduce the risk of not being able to service customers or have key components ready at the right time in manufacturing processes. I mean, I've even had a hairdresser cancel an appointment this week because they can't get the dye the right colour because it's held up at the border and their warehouse is out of it. So it does like have this knock-on effect throughout. But when it comes to that reshoring, I think there are some areas where there are real opportunities and also opportunities to develop our own industries, particularly in the low carbon economy, and make sure that we have got that local supply chain base here. There are real challenges with it, though, some of which are the cost of doing business in the UK, because even pre-energy crisis, the cost of energy in the UK was significantly higher than in key competitors in continental Europe. So if you're a manufacturer, actually, that is a challenging one to navigate. There's also some of the realities of it's quite hard to mix up your supply chain and change things around. You know, we've got a company, for instance, that was looking to change their plastic supplier because the current plastic supplier can no longer reliably provide the plastic they need when they need it. But the product they make is to a particular standard, and that standard requires a particular type of plastic, and that plastic isn't produced in the UK. So it gets right down to these very micro level issues that are very challenging to overcome. So yes, I think some elements of that sort of reshoring, localization where possible, but global is still going to be here and it's still going to be important. And there's huge economies for businesses to look at exploring and exporting.
I think what is more likely to potentially become more localised and definitely more seasonal will be things like food in the future as we adjust towards just our preferences for climate change. And it will, climate change will make massive impacts to business models, especially, like I said, in those shortening of the supply chains. Because, for instance, if you're buying meat from Australia, you might have issues, especially with wildfire, of disrupting those farming lands and stuff like that. But there'll also be changes in terms of customers who just might not necessarily want to ship in meat from halfway across the world when you can potentially get it in the UK.
Yeah, I think it's the sustainability piece is massive, isn't it? Partly, as you say, on that local supply chains piece, but also just more widely that changing consumer preference. And where we're seeing in particular pressure on businesses to rethink their business models and think about their carbon footprint and role in sustainability is actually starting to trickle down from first it was public procurement. Now it's large corporates, part of it driven by legislation, part of it due to investor preferences. And that's now trickling down through their supply chains as they are requesting that measurement of carbon footprint, carbon action plans, and also the requirement to have key environmental and social governance policies in place in order to continue to do business with them. So it's an agenda that I think is only going to pick up partly from that consumer demand, but also, as I say, from the public sector, from corporates, and that gradual trickling down through the economy of those requirements.
I think the other thing will be is that governments as well are now actually starting to implement big regulation and laws that is going to impact businesses. So like the ban on combustion engine cars in 2030 will have a massive impact on business models, and it will also have a massive impact on infrastructure, especially when it comes to charging points. And I know in the West Midlands especially, it's making a massive impact with Tyersley Energy Park and battery stations that are being set up. do we think we'll be adjusting quick enough in the future? Because I don't know if anyone saw it, but there's a little, you know, documentary on Panorama where it was looking at the fact that there's just not the infrastructure to support, especially businesses and HGV drivers moving en masse towards this low carbon sector.
Yeah, there needs to be fundamental changes, doesn't there? I mean, already pre-pandemic, pre-energy crisis, there were concerns about whether the grid had capacity to support the level of electric car charging points and electric cars that we'd be looking at transitioning to over the coming years. And I know one of the pieces we've been calling for from the Chamber is for the government to look at how they can incentivise businesses to invest in their own renewable energy sources, even as simple as, you know, sticking up some solar panels. The technology has moved on so well now that there are actual real opportunities to encourage businesses to do this in a way that's both sustainable and good for the environment, but also contributes to their own energy security and reducing their own energy costs as well.
I think it might go back to that old system of the government having to help businesses maybe again, especially when it comes to things like heat pumps, because heat pumps, you're looking at them costing £10,000 or £15,000. But small SMEs aren't going to be able to pay that out, especially when they actually cost more to run and operate than a gas boiler would.
And they're not suitable for all properties either. You have to have high levels of insulation. So it's the retrofit agenda is huge. We could probably do a whole podcast on the retrofit agenda, because we can't hit net zero without it, but it is hard.
I think the last thing that might be an impact going forward in the future is this aging population. I think in a few, by 2030, we're going to have 1 in 5 people over the age of 65. And that's causing massive issues in countries like China at the minute, where the one baby policy now means that you've got an over 65 population, double the size of its middle, you know, independent population. Going forward, the grey pound, as they call it, is going to have much more significance maybe than even those that are coming after them, which could politically mean a lot of changes in business models catering more towards the older customer. It could help city centres actually in a way in the long run, because you'd have a bigger population being able to go to city centres during the week. But the question is will they engage with online shopping the way that younger people do? So will they help to keep city centres alive potentially?
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? I did spot some stats from the Financial Times that estimate something like the baby boomer generation controls around 80% of UK private wealth and property and is expected to account for 70% of transferred wealth. So we see a lot of thought leadership on, well, what does Gen Z think? How do they behave? What are they going to be like as consumers? We still see quite a bit on millennials, although as a millennial myself, I think we're now pretty established rather than a challenger generation now. We are the middle age. The baby boomer dynamic is still very much, they're a good target demographic. So I know for businesses who aren't thinking about it already, it does sound like that's a pretty canny strategy to look at how you engage with that community as well. But when it comes to digital adoption, I mean, there's obviously still a lot of research that digital among older generations, there is less wide adoption, but increasingly that baby boomer generation, they're just as savvy on their smartphones as many others and happy to engage in online shopping, but perhaps with some differences in their behaviours. I think I saw some of your research from your proposition that they've perhaps got different ways of interacting with brands and different priorities when it comes to what they buy.
Yeah, they've definitely got different priorities. And I think, especially for older people, it's more, they'd be more apt to buy bigger things online. I mean, young people do it anyway, but young people also use it to do a quick shop at Amazon. But I think going forward, online will be such a massive part. And like you said, people are getting far more tech savvy. But I think city centres are still going to be massive, and you're going to have to keep enticing them in somehow. And I think going forward, the main mega trends really are probably going to be climate change, automation, and moving to online. And how it will impact business models is going to be interesting to see, especially because, you know, online, while seen as more environmental friendly, isn't innocent in its own right. To power all those generators, it's going to take a lot of energy. But I think business operations are going to have to learn to increasingly deal with more and more high pressure situations, especially as it's become more global and contagion is more of an issue from those global neighbours. So thank you for joining us, Henrietta. It's been very interesting. I know I didn't stick to the script as I should, but it just flowed, so we went with it, which is all great. But thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.